Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist from the 11th of January 2020. This one is Easy Ways to a Better You, their feature cover story. And look, I think remembering there's some interesting aspects to it. Self-improvement needn't be difficult. You can get a lot of benefit by simply tweaking the everyday things you do without thinking. Whether it is breathing, sitting, relaxing, eating, walking, or defecating, there's often a better way. There's often a way to do it better. So, I don't know who this article is by, but breathing. It may be the most natural thing in the world, but breathing is surprisingly easy to get wrong. And that matters more than you might think. For most of the time, the right way to breathe is through your nose. The pointy thing stuck at your face is exquisitely designed to trap dust and foreign bodies in its hairs and snot. Beyond your visible nose lies the nasal cavity. Inside, I would say, a cavernous space the size of a gaping mouth. It's lined with folded membranes designed to warm and cool the air to body temperature, add moisture, and trap pathogens in yield and yet more mucus. Your sinuses, air-filled spaces that connect to the nasal cavity, swirl the air around more and add nitrous oxide, which kills bacteria and viruses and relaxes. I didn't know that. And relaxes the blood vessels in the respiratory tract, allowing more oxygen to pass into the blood. The upshot is that the nose breathing adds 50% more air resistance than breathing through the mouth. That gives your heart and lungs a workout and increases the vacuum in your lungs, which allows you to draw up to 20% more oxygen than breathing by mouth. If it wasn't enough, the nasal breathing boosts brain function too. Young mouth-breathing rats were slower to complete a maze than nose breathers when they reached adulthood. They had fewer neurons in the hippocampus, a part of the brain important for learning and memory. Studies in people reveal, so that would be interesting, it's intelligence and breathing disease. Studies in people reveal that we also do better in memory tests when we breathe through our nose. The explanation is that nasal cavity has directed aligned to the emotional and memory processing centers in the brain via sensory neurons that connect the breath to the brain's olfactory bulb. As well as carrying messages about sense, these neurons sense the air moving in and out of the nasal cavity and lock brainwaves to the same rhythm. Synchronized brainwaves then spread beyond the scent processing brain areas into regions responsible for memory, emotional, and cognition. Nil by mouth. Many of us are missing out on these benefits. According to some estimates, more than 50% of children and 61% of adults breathe through their mouths too often. Well, there you go, according to some evidence. As a result, we risk bad breath, poor sleep, learning difficulties, tooth decay, and even malformations of the jaw. If you suspect you are an accidental mouth breather, you could set an alarm to remind yourself to check your breathing throughout the day. You could buy strips of tape, strips to tape your mouth shut at night. However, evidence is that this works is confined to one small study, which found that it reduced snoring and sleeplessness in people with mild obstructive sleep apnea. As for how fast we breathe, if it's calm you seek, slow it down to about 6 breaths per minute. This triggers a reflex that widens blood vessels and reduces heart rate. Concentrating on long, slow exhalation also stimulates the vagus nerve, which is in charge of the rest and digest response. The opposite of flight or flight, breathing more slowly might still even lull you into an intense state of consciousness. At 3 breaths per minute, theta brainwaves increase together with a zoned out state that looks like slow wave sleep, a deep state of slumber. Whatever rate, nose breathing is the way to go. And you might want to hum a little tune. Humming sets up swirls in the air and silence, which boosts production of nitrous oxygen 15-fold, which are all with all its immune and cardiovascular benefits. It's the only time the nose breathing falls short is when you need to fill your lungs quickly. It can be emergency. In emergency, gasp for air through the mouth works wonders. Just try not to make a habit of it. Claire Williams. That's really interesting. I don't see how nose breathing increases nitrous oxide. How that could possibly be true, except if it's a trace amount. I that's beyond my belief. Nitrous oxide would be good to read about. It's interesting that N2, NO, O2, CO, carbon monoxide, you've got all these things which go through, so it's a double bond. It's really interesting, these are all stable molecules that for some reason people like to do oxygen and nitrogen, but then the other ones I find it difficult to do. When it comes to sitting properly, we all know the drill, even if we don't do it to the letter. No slouching or crossed legs, buttocks touching the back of the chair, feet to the ground. But even if you're doing it right, sitting for long periods is shockingly bad for you. It's been described as the new smoking linked to heart disease, diabetes, and even cancer. There's no doubt we should all try to do it less of it. Perhaps we could do it better. Chances you are viewing this sitting as synonymous with chairs. This is particularly Western perspective. A classic survey published in 1953 described 100 different sitting postures adopted in 480 cultures around the world. Among the most common were sitting cross-legged, kneeling, and deep squat, with feet flat on the ground, buttocks resting just above it. Even Western cultures, these prefer sitting positions among young children, but Westerners tend to enforce chair use from an early age, strapping toddlers to buggies, and insisting children sit in school. One big problem is this passion for chairs is they make sitting so well sedentary. Consider Hadzaada, a hunter-gatherer people in Tanzania. They spend around 9 hours a day sitting. However, they squat and sit on the ground in various positions. The activity monitors reveal this entails significant levels of muscle activity. The supportive nature of chairs, their higher backs and armrests remove the efforts, perhaps the reason that people love them. Another problem with chairs is toll they take on the spine. When standing, our back is naturally S-shaped curved. However, sitting, many people curve the spine in a C-shape, compressing the discs between the vertebrae and putting them in the risk of back injuries. Quote, normal chairs tend to flatten the lower part of the back and put more pressure on it, says Josette Brittany-Solikoff of Tessal University, UK. So what's the best way to sit? Brittany-Solikoff has found that kneeling... Kneeling or using a stool as a saddle seat, it can help keep the spine in a better position, as does squatting. We might also take inspiration from traditional cultures like Hazata. Quote, use a variety of postures, preferably not just still postures, but some which allow movement, says physiotherapist Leon Stracker of Curtin University, Australia. More radically, Stracker believes we should be rethinking what it means to do a desk job. We will need to design workspaces to enable people to be productive while being highly active, like with under-the-desk cycling or a walking desk. For now, if your job is sedentary, don't forget to stand up regularly and stretch your legs, Alison George. Well, there you go. I do cognitive training on a treadmill. There you go. That's could be... It's sort of like an optimization. Okay. Relaxing. After a long day's work, I commute home, put the kids to bed, eat dinner, and do the washing up. Finally, at 9 p.m., I sit down with my wife and switch on the most glorious of domestic appliances, the television. It pains me to admit it, but I've been looking forward to this for hours. All of this deserves some time to relax. It makes us feel happy and is a natural antidote to fatigue. There's also a mounting evidence that continuous high levels of stress leads to chronic inflammation, which is terrible for physical and mental health. But is watching the box the best I can do? At least I can console myself that I'm not alone. When journalists Claudia Hammond and Gemma Lewis of the University College London asked 18,000 people from 134 countries what they do to relax, Watching television was among the top 10 activities. And, as Hammond says in her book, The Art of Rest, while some see as mindless, it is often a shared activity, so arguably less mindless than solitary forms of relaxation. The survey also found 68% of people wanted more rest. I feel likewise. I wonder whether that is partly because my second favourite relaxation activity might not be actually helping. Running might not be restful for my body, but it clears my mind like nothing else. I asked clinical psychiatrist Patricia Graber of the New York Medical College whether that counts. She suggests, I think, about relaxation in terms of sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems. Both are involved in unconscious actions. But the sympathetic nervous system ramps up the fight-or-flight response, generating damaging particles called free radicals. Parasympathetic system kicks in when you relax, giving your body a chance to recover. Quote, when you're jogging, you don't feel in danger, says Gritberg. This means it taps on your sympathetic system. We are also, people often jog out in nature, and there's something about bringing the natural world that is restful, she says. On top of that, exercise produces a feel-good chemicals called endorphins. Nevertheless, there are times when I feel I need to stress relief. It's recording. Stress relief. But I don't have time to jog or watch TV. What I need is sort of micro-relaxation. Would mindless fit the bill? Mindfulness. There is evidence that this reduces activities in the amygdala, part of the brain involved in the flight-or-flight response. At its simplest, it involves merely stopping what you are doing and paying attention to your thoughts and environment. A quiz developed by researchers at La Salle University in Philadelphia reveals that I am indeed moderately mindful. Here is a skill I can consciously cultivate to relax at any time of day. I try walking for a bus mindfully, focusing on the details of what I see, hear, smell, and feel. I find it calming and frustrating. If I really want to crack relaxation, I've got to work a little bit harder. Joshua Howgego. Really interesting. Eating. We're constantly bombarded by advice on what to eat, but what about how to eat? It turns out this too can have a big impact on your waistline and your well-being. Take meal times. Many of us eat our largest meal in the evening. It's worth rethinking this habit. Our bodies are more sensitive to insulin in the morning, meaning the postprandial spike in glucose falls faster after any early meal than after one taken late in the day. As a consequence, front-loading your daily food consumption is likely to reduce your risk of developing diabetes. It's good for your gut and health digestion too. Gastric emptying and overall gut motility is faster, and many enzymes, peptides, and bile acids are higher in the morning, says Leon Roddick-Collins of the University of Aberdeen, UK. You also benefit from regular mealtimes. Eating helps regulate genes and control your body clock, and processes coordinated by it become disrupted if you change the times at which you eat. If weight loss is your aim, you can benefit even more from this by confining your meals to a shorter window. Simply by delaying breakfast for 90 minutes and having dinner 90 minutes earlier, people have lost twice as much body fat over 10 weeks as those who kept the usual meal times. So, an early dinner is the way to go, isn't it? So, perhaps snacking when you're at work might be the best thing. How fast you eat matters too. Chewing your mouth 100 times may be overdoing it, but you do eat less if you eat slowly, probably because it takes 20 minutes for the hormones released in response to eating to kick in and make you feel full. Fast eaters also tend to have higher levels of triglycerides in their blood, a key marker in metabolic syndrome. It isn't clear why. Nevertheless, Indira Paz Granel at Ratovi Il Vilgini Virgi University in Spain, who led the research, has some tips for guzzlers. She suggests you might focus on your food, sit down and avoid distractions such as television, computer and mobile phones. Eat foods in high in fibre that require more chewing, and serve meals that need cutting up, putting your knife and fork down after each mouthful. Well, there you go. Finally, there's a tricky question of whether it's best to eat alone or company. Busy lives and single-occupant houses mean that solo eating is more common than in the past. This might be a good thing. Helen Ruddock, University of Liverpool, UK, has found that we eat more when dining with friends. But there is more to life than cutting calories. There's also evidence that people who eat socially are happier and more satisfied with their life than those who eat alone, she says. Quote, well, there you go. Evidence of her own thoughts, perhaps. What solution to dine with strangers? We tend to go for smaller portions then, perhaps to make a positive impression. Alternatively, explore the power of social contagion. Our dietary habits converge to the habits of other people in our social network, says Ruddock. So maybe find a friend who eats well and likes to take time with it. Anyone want to join me for a literary brunch? Julia Brown. Bathroom basics. Hints to get the most out of your personal hygiene routine. Teeth cleaning. Do make it a priority. Good oral hygiene may save off dementia. Because bacteria that cause gum disease are also linked to Alzheimer's. Don't rinse after brushing. Just spit it and retain as much fluoride as possible, especially at night when you produce less saliva. Your natural defense against acid attack. Hand washing. Do sing happy birthday twice. And this will ensure that you scrub your recommended 20 seconds before rinsing. Don't forget to dry your hands on a clean towel. Wet hands pick up germs more readily. And the friction of drying removes bacteria that remain after washing. Skincare. Do wash your face twice a day. Cleanse at night, especially important to remove pollutants that age the skin. Don't shower every day. It strips the skin of its protective oils and may disrupt its microbiome, allowing malign microbes to take hold. Every other day is usually plenty. Shaving. Do you shave the direction of the growth? It helps prevent razor bumps and burns and protects against ingrown hairs. Don't forget to shave against the grain for a closer shave. Be sure to reapply gel using gentle strokes. I don't know what that means. Okay. Do. Toenails straight across. This helps prevent ingrowth. Fingernails, however, should be cut with a curve. Don't believe in the myth about white marks. They don't indicate lack of calcium, but are formed when the nascent nail is damaged within the bed. Ear cleaning. Do listen to your parents' sage words, and don't put anything smaller than your elbows in your ears. Yes, this means no cotton buds, because they can lead to infections, perforated eardrums. Ears are self-cleaning, so let them get on with it. Walking. Bipedalism is such the clearest way to get about that few species have settled on it. Yet, despite the absurdity of moving while trying to balance on two tiny platforms, we rarely give our steps a second thought. Perhaps we should. Although we all walk more or less in the same way, there's enough variation between individuals to easily tell people apart. Such differences could even be used as a biometric password. That is interesting. Some quirks of gait can be problematic, though. Small variations in leg swing mean your heel hits the floor with enough force to damage the knee cartilage. A case of knee osteoarthritis has doubled in the past 50 years. Which some people say is too fast. To be explained by the longer lifespans, or even rising obesity. In that period, though, shoes have become more supportive, which encourage more forceful stride. Walking barefoot in a flat, flexible, minimalist shoe reduces the stress on knees. High heels, unsurprisingly, do the opposite. One way to walk can also affect your outlook. In experience, people manipulated into walking with an upbeat gait remembered more positive words from a list, whereas those who walked with a sad gait remembered more negative words. Nearly anyone holding a smartphone is likely to walk with their gaze towards the floor. This not only slows you down, but risks your neck strain and possible injury. If you want to improve your walking technique, the internet is awash with guides. However, biomechanics researcher Richard Jones at the University of Salford, UK, says there's little evidence that changing your gait reduces the future risk of injury. Gait is variable, and that is fine unless there are symptoms, he says. What matters is more about walking is how much we do it, not how, says evolutionary anthropologist Daniel Lieberman of Harvard University. Studies of modern hunter-gatherers and super-healthy postal workers indicate that we should aim for 2 hours of brisk walking a day. Most of us manage only a fraction of that. So never mind your idiosyncratic gait, just do it. So I do 2 hours of brain training walking. So there you go. Defecating. For the past few years, I've been defecating differently. A few weeks. All my life, when I needed to relieve myself, I sat upright on my toilet, feet flat on the floor. Now I rest my feet on a plastic stool, elevating my knees. The stool is called a squatty potty, and it's becoming increasingly popular. Partly thanks to a viral video featuring a unicorn that poops rainbow-coloured ice cream. But is squatting really better, or is this all just marketing hype? Certainly sitting upright to avoid isn't natural. For most of our species' histories, humans squatted bending their knees and sticking out their bottoms. About 2/3 of people still do this. Of course, naturally, it doesn't necessarily mean better. However, medical professions are starting to implicate conventional toilets with use in many abdominal disorders, including constipation, bloating, and possibly hemorrhoids. And a recent review of sitting upright to defecate even concluded that it's time to put this unfortunate experiment to an end. An argument for squatting is all about ankles. Most of the time, a muscle called the puborectalis pulls your rectum to a sharp angle, trapping the feces inside. When you defecate, the muscle relaxes and the rectum straightens out, allowing the contents to flow. However, if you sit upright, the rectum can't properly straighten. Squatting eliminates this kink, so you should manage the things easily. A handful of studies have addressed the sit-or-squat dilemma. One found that squatting allowed people to empty their bowels faster and with less straining. Another showed that the rectum really is straighter when people squatted. A third employed stopwatches and timed bowel movements with and without a footstool. On average, they took just 56 seconds while squatting, half the sitting rate. The thinker. So far, studies all have a small sample size, and there's also no randomized controlled trials. There is also no evidence to support the wild claims that sitting to defecate makes you more susceptible to appendicitis. Nevertheless, a team led by Leela Nestharan of the Pelvic Health Center at Stanford University in California does have unpublished results that bolster the case for squatting, at least if you have chronic constipation. My own limited experience supports the idea that people with such medical conditions are likely to benefit most. Personally, I haven't noticed much difference while using the squatty potty. However, a friend with irritable bowel syndrome found it transformative. Even so, squatting isn't for everyone. Quote, some people cannot flex their knees or hips, says Nithwan. Luckily, there's an alternative. In 2016, a study examined what happened when people sat with their feet flat on the floor but leaned forward and rested their elbows on their knees. The team called the Thinker. After August Rodin's sculpture, like squatting, this posture straightens the rectum and defecation easily. Do try this at home. So that's defecating. Okay, so we'll just put that out, and that's 23 minutes. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.